Good morning. It's December 5th, 2008. We are having a conversation this morning with Mr. Bill Huber. Again, we're in the hallway of the National Transit Building. Mr. Huber is one of those rare breeds of human beings that you read about in the paper and you hear about, but very few of us ever actually get a chance to talk with one of these fellows. He's an actual producer of crude oil in Pennsylvania, a guy who spent his entire life out in the woods drilling for crude and bringing it up, and he's had his ups and downs, and that's going to be our subject this morning. And thank you, Bill. Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you here. Now, you and I were talking just before we got started on this. Of course, we're now on December 5th, 2008. We're talking about $42 a barrel or so oil, a far cry from where it was just 6 months ago and certainly a year ago. You've experienced these highs and lows, these rapid turns in price, and of course the great highs, but also the great lows. And this is just deja vu for you. You've gone through this a number of times in your 50 years in the business, isn't that right?
Yeah, we've weathered a lot of ups and downs over the years. Back when I went to work for my dad, which would have been I started pumping for him when I was 12 years old, but we were getting $3.65 a barrel for oil then, and it kind of floated along at $3.65 to $4.65 up until probably 73, and then it started to move up, and then from 73 it took us into the first high peak at $35. We thought we died and went to heaven right there. But it caught me. I'd spent quite a bit of money, had a lot of plans, and all of a sudden in 89 we were at $9 a barrel. Well, I spent the next 10 years trying to get it back out of debt again. I drilled some wells, but I borrowed money to do it, and you got to pay it back. And then this last boom, we didn't do anything drastic. We just figured we had enough wells out there that maybe we just ought to try to get as much old stuff together as we could, you know, rather than borrowing money and spending money to drill with. You just hate to get caught twice.
Yeah, I recall you saying, maybe 9 months ago, you really were considering drilling another well, a totally new well. Did you ever actually do that?
Well, the guy's supposed to come and get me a couple of permanent settings, and I still might do that, especially if we start to, but you've got to do it. Well, you've got to do it. So the way I would do it anymore, I wouldn't go and borrow the money. Let's put it that way. I probably could, but I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I'd try to finagle enough money, and we were at the point we could have done that. I think, you know, pulled enough money out 2 or 3 months in a row and had enough money to drill well. But right now, that's kind of off the table, but I'm hoping maybe it'll come back. And it wouldn't have to come back to $100 either. But
really, that's a good point. Where would it have to be? What do you consider a good price for crude from the standpoint of a producer making it viable for him to continue?
Well, I had a discussion with some other producers here about a week ago. We all kind of concluded that what you were talking about earlier, about $70 a barrel, we could handle. $70 to $80, we could do our drilling programs and make some money.
Makes it worth your while. Yeah, it's worth the risk, that kind of money. And that is, I think, the general consensus throughout the world, actually, that from a producer standpoint, that's the kind of money you need for crude.
Back in 80, we could drill a well for $25,000 and pretty well take care of the well. Now that figure's moved to 65,000.
One well.
So, you know, it's a pretty good investment when you think about it. You know, 65,000. Now there's another route some of them have went, and that's get investors. I get a group of guys together, and you want to put in 10 and 10 and 10, you know, and maybe, or more, or you get another group that's a little bigger than that, and when you get enough money, but you're all shareholders in that well. So, but you hate to do, well, I know in the early boom, there was a lot of investors that never seen their money back, never seen it back. I'm one that if I'm going to take in a group of fellows to with me, I want to make money, but I want them to make money. So, you know, some of them purely were out there just to get that investor money, and they didn't care. They didn't even care if the well got drilled, some of them. So. Mm-hmm. As long as they got your money.
Well, that might be your approach.
Maybe that's the difference between a promoter and a producer. I don't know.
Bill, for those who don't have an idea at all what your lease is like, why don't you kind of tell us where it is, or at least the one you're currently running anyhow, and how you physically describe it, and also the equipment you use, and the history of some of that great old equipment you have out there, that kind of thing. We can't take it for granted that this audience will know really what you're doing out there. So why don't you just set the scene, if you will, for your operation?
Well, I have actually three pieces of property out there, all within a mile of each other. The biggest piece has 571 acres in it. There are probably 110 or 15 wells on that property. Most of them are the old rod line power that goes back to the 1900s, where they run them with a shackle line or a rod line, we call them. Maybe one unit will run 20 wells at a time. The second property has about 26 wells on it, but most of them are on jacks. There's no power there. It's all individual jacks. And then the third property is a small property. It's only 20 acres, but there's 9 wells on it, and they're rod line wells. There's one new frack well on it, and the rest of them are. And I say new, it was new in the 80s, we drilled it. And it's a 15 horse reed, which was built here in Oil City. It started, I think the patent says 1898 on most of them. Mm-hmm. Now,
your big central power, is that off of a gas engine? Or is
yeah, that,
off
had, gas? That had a 15 horse reed on it. We didn't have enough gas to run the engine anymore, so I converted it to an electric motor. There's an electric motor sets there with a set of E-belts on the wheel. It spins the flywheel, and of course, everything else is the same. It's got the big 10-inch belt that goes out to an oil well supply power built here in Oil City. Most of this equipment was built here in Oil City.
Yeah.
It was part of the, you know, what are they talking about with GM, all the satellite companies? Well, when the oil was back in, you know, we had all the satellite companies here that built equipment, designed and built this equipment specifically for here.
Yes, yeah, right. Right, in fact, let's kind of focus on that just a little more. The kinds of drilling you do is with cable tools. Your wells were originally drilled with that, an up and down motion, literally with a cable, with a string of tools at the end of it, was a big heavy piece that had a chiseled
bit on it.
People outside of Pennsylvania, and even in Pennsylvania, they don't realize that's the kind of drilling you do, and that's the kind of drilling we do here in Pennsylvania. They see in the movies and on TV the big rotary drills that are we associate with Texas and Oklahoma. We don't do that. You don't do that. You use
Yeah, everything I drilled up until 1980 was with cable tool. Now, the first rigs were wooden. In fact, the first rig I went to work on was a wooden machine with a temper screw. I say the Colonel Drake thing, you know. I was 16 years old. I dressed tools on that rig all summer. Then at that time, or a little earlier than that, the Sputter come in, and they were an all-steel machine with no walking beam. They did have a beam, but you didn't have a temper screw. Your line come up through the beam like this and over the derrick, and to let out the line, all you had to do was lift the brake a little bit, and that'd give you whatever amount of line you were looking for. I went to work for Ron Brown in 1967. And he had three rigs, three Bessyra series sputters. And we met at Peach's Restaurant in Pleasantville, and I usually left my vehicle there. And I never knew what rig was mine for the day. He'd take you out there and drop you off, and you either drilled or you sat there and watched the birds all day. But you were there. Mm-hmm. And I literally had been around that all my life, but I literally never actually learned to drill till I had no choice. I had to drill. The machine was mine, and if I wanted to keep the job, and at that time crude oil was only like four something a barrel, so I worked for him, pumped. I did my pumping, and then I got good enough that Taylor Drilling hired me. So I worked all day for Brown, come off at 4 o'clock for Brown, and on for Taylor from 4 o'clock to 1 in the morning. Mm. And still did the pumping. It was a tough job to try to get all that done.
Sure was.
Used to got laid down, and it was 6 o'clock, time to get up and go again.
But you were a young man.
Yeah.
You could do all that. Did they pay you well?
Well, you know, I got $1.25 an hour.
Oh, that much?
Yeah.
I think I made that at Isley's.
Yeah.
Same time.
Yeah. Later on, we made, I ended up moving from drilling into service work. I did service work for years and years for pretty near every company out there. And the service work is where you have a machine, but we call it a pulling machine, where we pull the pipe and the rods and all that stuff out, fix it up, put it back in again. And I worked from Grand Valley to Bowie Hill, about everywhere in between.
People don't realize, if you're not around the industry, you don't just drill and then pump. Around here, they're all pumpers on Buck Floyd's. But you clean them out with some, I won't say regularity, but they have to be cleaned out. And that's real, the real work. And most often when you see something, a rig over a well out there in the woods, that's really what they're doing,
they're pulling. Yeah.
Your wells are typically how deep out there in the around?
Well, pulling? From down on the lower end on Cherry Run, they're 450, but you go back up to the top of the hill and they're 1,050. So.
And are they cased how far down?
About 300 feet. Well, the casing averages with the water table. If you're down here, let's say in Oil City, your water table here would probably go from 150 to 200 feet. Somewhere in there, that's all you'd have to put in. But if you go up here on the Hogback, you'd probably have to run 300, 280 to 300 feet up there to get through that surface water.
That's a lot of pipe. That's a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And even with a machine, it's still a lot of manpower.
Yeah.
I noticed, you've told me, I ask you all the time, how's your hands? You've taken a beating out there over the years.
Yeah. We anymore, any the arthritis gets to me some days.
Now your son helps you.
Yeah. He's been with me. Actually, he started like I did. My dad used to take me in a basket when I was
little kid, an infant.
And I did the same thing with Billy. I used to take him. I don't remember as I had a basket, but I used to take him. And I had a big old box in the engine house set on the wall. Oh, just kept odds and ends in it. And I'd get a bunch of clean rags and lay them in that basket or that box. With the engine, the old engine running in there, it's kind of like a heartbeat, he'd just sweep right through. You know, I didn't have to worry about it.
A lullaby of an engine running a central power. That's something else. And the squeaking. It's rhythmic, if you think about it. For those that haven't been out there, there's a lot of squeaking.
They play all these records for these kids anymore to keep them calm. I don't know. My daughter-in-law had some of them for my granddaughters. But that old gas engine was as good a recording as you could have got.
All right, so that you mentioned your son, and of course your dad, and I believe you told me you're actually the fifth generation, is that correct?
I'm the third generation.
Okay, third, and then there's a grandson who you hope to get in?
Well, I haven't got any grandsons yet.
Well,
there's a possibility.
Maybe we someday predicted something here.
I've got two granddaughters.
Okay, I don't know. You don't expect them to be.
The only one that's married is the youngest son. Uh-huh. And he has two girls. And he and I own a lease together. He's still in the business, although he works full-time at Meadville Medical Center. So the only time he gets to come out much is on Saturdays and days off when he don't have something else he has to get done. So
people don't realize. Of course, Pennsylvania wells are typically stripper wells.
Yeah.
You're lucky if you get 5 barrels a day. That'd be really good production.
That'd be a good well.
Really, typically, what would you say an average well produces around here?
Quarter of a barrel a day.
Quarter of a barrel, right. So you got to run a lot of wells. You got to pump a lot of wells to get the kind of monthly production you need to make it worth your well. And even at that, you still oftentimes have to have another job, right?
Yeah.
And folks should realize that. It's In Pennsylvania, it's...
For years and years, most of the producers, like me, they had, some of them may have worked in, like, Joy or someplace. Maybe worked nights, and then they run their lease during the day and slept, like they maybe come home from work at 7 and go to work, pump their lease, do whatever they wanted to do, come home maybe at 12 or whatever, and sleep for a few hours, and then go back to wherever they worked for the, you know, their shift. So, I mean, I think there's probably still some out there doing that. But Don Taylor, a good friend of mine, he has 3 drilling rigs, 3 spudders.
Mm-hmm.
And for years and years, he did, still does, operates them spudders and pumps his leases. And probably if he didn't, he does a lot of work in the gas field. He's got a couple of big spudders.
Mm-hmm.
It'll go 3,000 feet. And he overhauls these gas wells for these people, like over around Clarion and down towards Butler. And I think he's currently working in Cook's Forest on one up there.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's the way we lived. That's what we did, you know. I used to do the service work, pull wells. So maybe you had 10 wells over here, you got 2 or 3 that need worked on. So I'd come over and do the work, but I still had to keep my stuff running. So, you know, that's kind of how most of the local producers lived over the years here. That's the way they made it.
Yeah. The number of producers, the independent producers we have in, let's say, northwestern Pennsylvania. I would include, we have to go up to the Bradford Field and include that. What do you think that actually represents? How many guys are actually in that independent producers, Pennsylvania independent producers?
455 currently, but we know there's some out there that aren't in it. There's still more out there, but they just don't belong to the organization.
And would that represent essentially the number of active producers out in the woods?
Yeah.
Well, it's still viable. It's still.
That's from Bradford to Butler.
Down to Butler.
Yeah.
Butler. Yeah, Butler County. Yeah, right. So we're still at it. Pennsylvania still has that tradition. Are you using, or have you used, any of these secondary recovery techniques? Let's just take the easy one first. I think you used, you torpedoed one or two of your wells, didn't you? Why don't you tell folks what that's kind of like and what that does?
Originally, we torpedoed every new well we drilled. And when I say torpedo, it takes, depending on the size of your hole, how much nitro you can get in there. In a 5 5/8 hole, you can get 5 quarts of nitro to the foot in the formation. So if you've got 20 feet, you can get 20 times 5, you can get 100 quarts of nitro in that formation.
We're talking about the producing sand, what we would call the sand.
So we set that in there, in that formation, and then set it off. Well, it blows a hole back in it and enhances the production. It's an old, old proven method that still works. You can still use it. Nobody much does. I had a guy tell me I just didn't cut. He told me the other day I just wasn't with the new age. He says, you're still one of them nitro guys. I said, well, you know, we know it works. I said, there's no question in my mind that nitro doesn't work. Then that came to hydrofracking, and hydrofracking is just hydraulic water pressure on that formation. Say you got 20 feet of sand, you've got 4 places in there that shows up that on what we call an electric log, that theoretically shows production, more production in that section than any of the other sections of the sand. So they put a notch in there with an air sand notch with an air and sandblasting, and they just keep turning that till it cuts a ring right there. And then they set a packer down here and a packer up here. Well, maybe you only got a foot of sand, but that there was one packer here and one packer there. Then they pump that water, and I've seen them go up as high as 4,000 before they broke. Once they break, the pressure will drop right to 800 pounds. Then you start putting what we call a prop in there, which is actually just fine sand. And if you look at it under a microscope, it has no edges on it. It's all round. I don't know where they get it or how they get it, but that's what it is. And you might pump, we generally tried to get the rate up to 20 barrel a minute with 4 pounds of sand per gallon of water in there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that goes out in there, and that props that crack open.
Yeah.
So then when you're all done, you got to pump all that water you've pumped in there back out before the oil comes.
Mm-hmm. But that's a very effective way.
It's a very effective way. I've had wells make 100 barrel a day doing that.
Yeah. Now, for folks who aren't quite, they can't visualize it, those hydrofracking, that's done with these big trucks, heavy trucks. I think wells up here, what do you call them, the one up there in Meadville. Something wells, it's not coming to me the first name.
Yeah, I can't.
They go all over the country with their real big units, but these are huge trucks.
Yeah, they're huge. They have what they call a triplex pump on the pumper, which is got 3 pistons like that, high-pressure pistons. And they're powered by a Detroit 1,200-pound or 1,200-horsepower diesel.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you can push this building off its foundation or something like that. As far as pumping stuff in,
And the trucks, as heavy as they are, they bounce on the ground like that.
Then you've got your blender, and the blender truck, Well, he's a booster to the pumper, but he's also where they put the sand in. When they get ready for the sand, they dump the sand in the blender, and it mixes it with the water. And then you got your sand truck, depending on the size of your frack, usually one truck, but if it's a big frack, they may be two trucks there.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing we generally run in there is potash. Swelling, so you get a better flow back mm-hmm. on your well.
All of this costs money.
Yeah.
Because you use some very serious money.
Frack job, well, I don't know what one costs today. I had, in the 80s, I did 12. And we did with Halliburton. At the time, and Halliburton was like the Cadillac of the fracking trucks.
Mm-hmm.
You paid more for Halliburton than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And my frack jobs were $10,000 at the time, just for the frack job. That didn't mean the cost of the well or anything. That was just a frack job.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm supposing it would be somewhere around $15,000, maybe $20,000
mm-hmm.
now.
Expensive.
I haven't got a producer that's done it to commit to me what he paid for.
You gotta talk to those guys up in Bradford.
They
seem to be doing a lot of that stuff.
Now there's some individual people out of Bradford and up in that area that have bought frack trucks on their own.
It's cheaper.
And we had a set operating this summer. The guy paid $1 million for them three trucks. And they were brand splinter new trucks.
Yeah.
And he could set like where you're setting. And you could sit there with a laptop computer and you controlled that whole frack. There was operators on each truck, but those operators, all they did was to make sure the computer was telling that truck what to do, or that machine, what it was doing. I mean, I was amazed, you know. You could sit there with that engineer they have a little panel truck they usually bring with them, and you could watch that whole frack on the computer. You could even see it go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the computer would tell you. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's amazing how, you know, when we did it, it was guess by your pants and hope you got it right.
Oh, Bill, years and years ago. The crude had come up from the grind, put it in these storage tanks, big wood storage tanks. Are you still using the big wood storage tanks, or are you into...
I've got mostly steel.
Steel? Mm-hmm.
I've got one old wooden 60 barrels down over the hill. It's probably still usable. We just don't use it anymore, but we used to... Well, I used to fill it once a month. I used to run that 60 barrel full once a month.
Uh-huh.
And of course this time of year, back then they had pipelines.
Uh-huh.
So you had to heat it.
Yeah.
So we had a coil about 20 feet away from the tank that come off the bottom and come into the coils and went back halfway into the tank. and the bottom line came off on this side of the tank, the top line went to the opposite side of the tank. So, and we'd run 6 inches of water in there. Water heats easier than crude oil and holds the heat better. So we'd heat that water up, run it through that tank, and of course it would drop through that oil, go back to the bottom, and as it's doing all that, it's heating this tank, you know, and it worked really well. Probably one of the best heating systems I ever had, as far as getting, we could have that tank up to 60 degrees on a cold morning.
Is that right? Yeah. And of course it would flow then through
yeah.
the
Yeah, you had to watch and not get it too hot because the gauger wouldn't turn it on because he didn't want to send that hot oil down a cold line and bust the line.
And then also it expands, crude expands with heat, and they didn't want to take it too warm because they felt they were going to get cheated when it cooled off. So there was all kinds of plays on that thing.
They still do that today. You get a run slip and you'll see the temperature written on there, no matter whether it's summer or they take a certain percentage off depending on the temperature. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what it is because you never know. You just know, you know, well, they might have come out this morning and, well, that oil's 30 degrees. Now, I don't know what that means as far as do I get a better price at 30 degrees or if it was summertime and 60 degrees, do I get a better price? I don't know.
I know in the old days, the 19th century certificates that they gave the receipts again, they specified it could be no more than 80 degrees. And if it was more than 80 degrees, they discounted it because the volume they would receive once it cooled down would be a lot less. So, I don't know what they did today.
Maybe there's no big, but I know they used to do that a lot. I don't know how much they ever penalized anybody for it, you know, or whatever, but they still pay attention to that temperature even today. So
nowadays, big tank truck comes to your
Yeah, they've got, they can haul 160 barrel on a triaxle. And then they have two small trucks that will haul 100 at a time. If you've got small tanks, they send you out, they send the 100 barrel out. And they pay a premium for, if you got enough oil to fill up that 160 barrel tanker, you get a premium of $2 a barrel.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
I've never actually got that premium because usually I'm in that lesser class where they got to send the 100 barrel tanker out. So.
and not to pry into your business, but. Typically, you, at least in the last year or so, you've been doing about 100 barrels a month. Am I right on that? Or?
Just about. It varies. It varies from 60 to 100. Mm-hmm. If I've had a real good month, I'll have 100. I got a run going right now. It's probably going to end up in the 60 barrel class.
That's good.
Cold weather and all
slows it down.
Good stuff, you know, that comes with winter.
Currently you're selling with the Ergon?
Ergon, yeah.
And prior to that, who owned it? Who had
Quaker
rights?
Quaker State took it.
Quaker State, yeah.
I've sold to Crew Levick, National Transit. Yeah. Yeah,
that's amazing. When you mentioned Crew Levick, I'm going, wow, that was some time ago.
Yeah.
They became, City Service or something like that. And then that was a long time ago. And of course, National Transit.
Of course, I think when we were selling Crew Levick, that was probably when my dad had it.
Yeah. That'd be 1940s,
yeah.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah.
That's an old name. The Uber name's an old name, Bill.
Yeah.
It's kind of legendary. I'm going to put a plaque out there. People don't know. It's at least it's somewhere. You got to know where it is, but it's... If you know where the Plumber General Store is, which is a little community place, it's from there. You walk. You can walk. It's a bit of a walk, but it's right.
Everything. Well, my granddad Inslee, great granddad Inslee, came here from Germany,
Would that be by any chance related to Kay Inslee?
Oh, Kay. Yeah, Kay. Kay's part of the group.
An old plumber girl, right?
And then
he came.
He came. He homesteaded 167 acres over there, which is where my lease is. And then I don't know when he bought the other piece that I live on, which is the old Turner Farm Plumber, which is one of the original homesteaders of Plumber. Near as we could find out, I don't know whether Kay knows any more about this than I do, but we know, I know he was a cooper. And I know where his shop was,
Barrel,
down there by the bridge. And I think he was working for Humboldt Refinery.
Which is, for our audience, that's a very old name. We're talking 1860s when we said Humboldt Refinery. So that goes,
yeah,
that goes back. That's
back.
The beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Well, he had, was there, that's where I get, how many original Inslees were there? I think there were four boys and two girls, but I might be wrong about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, my granddad Huber, somewhere along, we don't know too much about him, my great-granddad Huber. He came here from Germany and he brought his wife with him. And they moved down in the hollow below the Inslee farm. And then Grandpa, great-grandpa took off. He left all of, and there was supposedly eight of them. I don't know. I've got to go to the courthouse and check that all out. But I know that my granddad worked at Oil Well when he was 12 carrying sucker rods because he was the sole support for them out there.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
And then somewhere along the line, he met an Inslee girl.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that, but
and he just couldn't resist.
Just couldn't resist. And they got married, and near as we can tell, they were all together in the business: the Inslee brothers and the Huber brothers, and they built drilling rigs.
Mm-hmm.
And we figured probably in the 1880s and 1890s they were building drilling rigs all over the. I have one thing that I found from Grandpa Huber where they built a couple rigs in Nealtown for a guy.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 1906, the story is that a promoter from New York came in, leased the old farm, and they built the rig, and they hired Uncle Henry Huber to drill it, and they drilled a well. And the well made 45 to 50 barrel a day, and they telegraphed New York and told them it was a dry hole and bought the well. Now that I don't know, I don't know whether that's true or not.
Oh, I don't believe that, Bill.
But anyway, they drilled that well. Of course, after that, you know, they drilled some better wells in on there, and they, and if you look at the old deeds in the courthouse, there was Inslee and Huber all over, like Eagle Rock area, Pit
yeah.
Hole.
Yeah.
I mean, the old deeds had their name. I don't know exactly how much at one time they had. I had a lawyer tell me one time, he says, well, I searched them deeds. He says, all I found was Huber and Inslee. I said, well, you know, they were active.
Yeah.
And they and Tracks over here put the money up to drill a Halp. And the Halp was the last flowing well in Plumber.
Yeah, right. A rather famous well.
Yeah.
When you're talking 45, 50 barrels a day, were they flowing or pumpers, do you recall? Either way,
most likely a 60 barrel well would have been pretty close. If it wasn't a floor, it was awful close.
It was close.
Yeah.
Yeah, those kind of numbers sound high. Those are big numbers.
Yeah.
And Pennsylvania, at least in those days, always enjoyed a premium on crude prices over Oklahoma, Kansas,
yeah,
California, Texas crude. So in those days, they were doing well, wouldn't you say?
Doing well.
Really well.
Mm-hmm. Now, number 10 on that same lease, it's marked right on my... I've got their old record book out there. Their drilling logs. They kept very good records. A lot of leases, some even that I've had, you just kind of got to guess what, you know, but... I don't know whether Grandpa Huber or L.R. Inslee, but they kept a record book. And they knew just exactly where that sand was and exactly where that oil came in at and all that stuff. But anyway, this well, number 10, said this well made 100 barrel a day from 6 feet of formation in the third sand. And, you know, it gives you the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
So I was lucky in that respect that they kept those good records.
Are those records still in your possession, in your family? And I'm sure everybody realizes how, let's call it, valuable they are, at least from a historical standpoint. Bill, we all know where the records are.
Well,
and hopefully you'll remember us as time goes on.
The Smith lease, which Max Smith married Mary Huber, and Max Smith was one of the drillers for Huber and Inslee, but I ended up with one of Max Smith's leases over the years, but I got no records of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they drilled all these wells in there. I got a pretty good idea, but there's nothing written down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes it's hard when you don't have anything written down or any idea, you know. It's nice to know that say, second sand is at 701 feet and runs to 720 feet or whatever it might be.
That's invaluable information. And in years to come, with the technology that they're developing because of the increased price of crude, who knows what's going to come back out of those sands?
Yeah.
They're not over yet.
No, I don't foresee us being, you know, maybe the price is down, and I think maybe it's going to go back up. But probably this oil's still going to be produced.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It's
there.
It's there.
And as long as it's there, you or somebody's going to go after it, right?
Right.
Yeah. That's the creed of the producer.
Yeah.
If it's there, we're going.
Yeah.
Even if you only give us a nickel for it, we're going to get it.
Yeah. About right.
That's really it.
It's like we were talking earlier. Nobody, nobody thought this $40 oil was going to happen, to be truthful. But everybody that so far is still doing their, I've only heard of a couple that are going to slack off because of the price.
Uh-huh.
They're all like I am. They're hoping it comes back, which I think it will. The demand for this oil, I think the biggest thing right now is the economy's got everything. I think if the economy would come back, so would oil. I don't know, you know, whether we'd go back to 150, but we definitely would come back from where we're at now. Because it's kind of like what we talked about, you know, our economy went down, so did China's, so did Japan's, and China was really buying the oil. They were buying it like it was no tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And that demand some of these days with the amount of people in China has to come back.
Yes. I might add on that, my wife happens to be in China right now, and it's her second trip. She sees those big drilling platforms all over along the coast of China. They're drilling out at sea. They're not like us and waiting. They're out there, and they're developing every reserve they possibly can. Yeah, right.
Well, of course, they were going on and on and on, and I do believe there's a lot of truth to it about our oil's going to run out. And in time, I guess it will. It has to. It's not a renewable resource. So we should be thinking about whatever we need to do.
the alternative
to go on from here, you know. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Bill, there are several films that are up at Drakewell in their archives, and I think you own copies of your father and his friends and brothers. I don't know what brothers, but one was actually working on the old U-release. That was when they torpedoed it. Mm-hmm. I think, when was that, in the 50s?
There's a part of that's in the 50s. The early part of it was 1940. And they were torpedoing, they were drilling and torpedoing with the old wooden Wolf machine.
Yeah, right.
And my dad was, and my granddad were great believers, and if you're going to shoot a well, shoot everything you can in it and shoot it with as much as you can get in it. Mm-hmm. So some of those shots on those films were 180 quarts of nitro coming out of the hole.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's something to see.
Yeah.
That's real dynamic.
You know, you just, as it comes out and it goes, you know, it's kind of like looking at Old Faithful. And if you've got a moldy shot in there, it just starts to fall off when the next one hits her and takes her right back up again. It's quite interesting, really.
Yeah. Were you there when those, let's see, I know you're about my age. You could conceivably could have been there for some of those shots anyhow.
Yeah. There was some there on the end of the film in the 1950s.
Yeah, yeah.
I was there for those. And then Dad drilled, that was in the 50s.
Now, was your family involved in that demonstration well that was built along Cherry Run below where you are?
The Drake thing?
Yeah, right. Were you?
You know, I don't know. I know O.W. Turk was.
Yeah, right. That's...
And if he was, probably some of our family was.
Uh-huh.
Because the plumber was pretty much...
Well, but even though that was built as an educational thing or a demonstration thing, nonetheless, has a lot of the old families involved.
Yeah.
And it definitely shows what it was like in the early days. And that film exists, too. I think Drake Well has that. Am I right on that?
I think Drake Well has that, yeah. Yeah.
That's one that in the future folks ought to at least look at.
Yeah, I think they ought to get it out and show it or something, you know. A lot of people, you know, we knew it existed, but there's a lot of people probably right here in the area, you know, even the Tri-City area, that didn't know that film was ever made here, maybe never even seen it. But
yeah. They
did a pretty good job for the time and the era they were working in, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Then now, Vincent Price made the next one. Of
that's
course,
right.
It was Hollywood style, but
now, because it is the we had this is the year or two, 2008, 2009. We're observing the 150th anniversary of Drakewell, and at the same time, concurrently, we didn't plan that, but concurrently, the price of crude went through the roof, and the entire world became interested in where the early wells were in Pennsylvania. And you attracted quite a crowd.
Yeah.
And let's have some fun here a little bit. Tell us what it's like to be a international star of stage, screen, and television.
Well,
how many interviews did you do for?
26.
26.
It started with the Wall Street Journal. And all he had was one of these telephone cameras. And he took some stuff on that. But it was a day like today when he was up, but it was in February. It was snowing, it was blowing, it was cold. He wanted to walk around up in there, so we did.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't believe my truck, we had about that much snow. I took him right up in. My truck was pretty good at getting, I got good roads, number one, but number two, it'll go in the snow pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So we were up in there, and of course he wrote the article, and that's the second time I was in the Wall Street Journal. The first time, oil went to $9, and they come out and interviewed me back in 89,
mm-hmm.
and then they come back and interviewed me again, although he had no idea that I'd been in the Wall Street Journal once before. So Well, then CBS nabbed that up, and they showed up. And that was quite a production. I had the Oil City Derrick reporters and photographers. I had Oil Heritage people there, and the CBS crew there, and you literally had to get a traffic cop up there at my engine house, yeah, direct traffic to get them out of there.
Uh-huh.
And then there again, it was cold.
Yeah.
And of course, this guy, I don't know where he come up with this idea. He wanted to know what crude oil tastes like. I said, well, taste it. Right there it is. He's standing there looking at it. I said, go ahead and taste it. And he looked at me, and I reached my finger in like that, and went, well, he either had to put up or shut up then. He had to do it.
Uh-huh.
So he tasted. Oh, he says, it ain't bad. I said, no, it ain't bad. It won't kill you. Well, of course, the rest picked up on that. And about every crew that came in there wanted to taste crude oil. I kind of still laugh about it. But we had, after that, the French came. The English came. These guys were out of London. And then the French came back again, but this was a different crew. Like you said, I must have been popular in Europe.
Yes, yes.
And then the third French crew showed up, and they wanted to do a documentary on me. And the one girl that was with, well, she did the talking, actually. And she says, you're very, very, very famous in France. And that's the way she said it.
I believe it. You're very, very famous around here, too. Did you tell them that?
Yeah.
And then I think also, weren't you the one that says, they can have the fame, I'll take the money, right?
Yeah. And then after that, the Japanese showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese are something else. They are... they're very nice people, but there certainly are, if you've never been around them, which I hadn't, you know, they came, and it was funny. They called and wanted to do this, and I said, fine, we'll, you know. Well, I thought they were going to do it that day. They made an appointment, and about 11 o'clock, this stretch limousine shows up in my driveway. My wife says, well, it's either the Japanese or the IRS. Have you done anything you shouldn't have done? I said, no, not that. No. Well, the Japanese come in. Well, the girl spoke very good English. Most all of these foreign people did. This man, and she said, this is the Imperial Japanese History Minister.
Hmm.
He flew here from Japan to meet you.
Mm.
Whoa.
Mm.
You know. So we talked, and they went over to the lease. Well, the day they went over, the first time they went over, you've been up there. Some days on a damp day, that belt gets water on it back there. And when it spins in, it sprays off.
Mm.
Well, they thought they were shot in there. I threw the clutch in, the belt come in, and the water sprayed, and him and her thought that somebody was shooting at them. They run down through the woods. We had to catch them. I think they were going back to Japan.
That's great.
Well, then they left, and they made an appointment to come back with the film crew. Well, they come back in about a week, and they had themselves and two videographers, is that what you call you guys? Anyways, they're up there in the back of my truck with a camera on their shoulders and their hats turned back. And they're videoing all the way out of the driveway over to the lease. And, you know, they videoed the whole thing, and all of them wanted to go up and see the crude oil coming out of the ground. And we did all that. They sent me a copy of what they made, and I'll have to give it to you. Have to see that.
Oh, yeah.
But there's only one shot, I think, of my engine house and that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But this film made with cartoon characters, and I mean, it starts out, it shows this Japanese girl doing things in a house, and I think they're going, I don't know Japanese, going on about what would happen if there was no crude oil, and the next scene shows her standing there like this, you know, nothing on.
That's mean, right.
And then it just keeps going on and on, and it shows this, looks like a general with his hand in here like this, and of course they're babbling on. I'd love to know
what they were actually
saying. Yeah. But I have the video.
They're probably saying, "That Bill Ewing, what a strange guy."
Well, then after that, who was the next one?
Fox?
British.
Oh, yeah, BBC.
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 And I did BBC radio and I did BBC television.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Then I did Swiss radio and Swiss television. I did German twice. I did the Italians. And then the one, and I'd love to see this work. This was on a, it was on a Sunday night. And we had been somewhere and come back, and I was watching television. And the phone rang. "Hey, Bill, it's McNerney." I said, "Oh,
John."
"John, yeah." He says, "I got Seanus Murphy here from Dublin, Ireland." I said, "Well, you know, I didn't know really what to say." I said, "Yeah? Well, he's a photographer and he likes to take pictures. Could he come out?" I said, "Yeah." "Well," he says, "I'll bring him out 11 o'clock tomorrow." I said, "Fine." Well, we hung the phone up for half an hour, and the phone rang again. "Hey, Bill McNerney, we're sitting in your driveway. Can we come in?" I said, "Yeah, I guess you're out here now." So they come in. This guy was a very nice guy, but definitely an Irishman. So he came out at 8 o'clock the next morning, and he never left till 5 o'clock that night. And I'll bet he took 200 rolls of film. He was on his belly in the powerhouse, taking the belt going over him, and all just stuff. And he promised me he'd send me some of his work, but I've never seen it yet. But
well, we're going to get it. Somehow or other, we're going to get it.
Somebody said he was the sixth-ranked photographer in the world. Now, I don't know if that's true or not either, but
well, nothing else. I'll tell you, a coffee table book. That's my.
He knew what he was doing when it come to taking pictures.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He got in that belt house with that belt running, and of course it was a nice day, and the sunlight was fingering through them old boards on there. You know, and oh, beautiful shot. He kept saying, "Beautiful shot." But his finger just kept going like that all the time. You figure he'd have a digital. But he didn't. He'd pull out another roll of film. And he had two cameras. One hung over here like a gunfighter with two guns, you know. And I'd say, "Well, what's two cameras?" Well, he says, "This is long range. This is short range over here."
Well, we're kind of coming to the end of our 1 hour. You mentioned this man knew what he was doing. You know what you're doing. And it's quite evident. Every time I talk to you, I honestly consider it a real honor for you to even bother to share a lot of what you have with me over the years, and certainly with everybody else around. It really takes a fellow like you to actually tell us what's going on, as opposed to what we think's going on, and that you've taken the time today to do that. I really appreciate it, Bill. I mean it. I appreciate how giving you've been to everybody over the last couple of years. It's an invasion of your life. We all know that. But you're a treasure. What you do is at the base of everything we talk about around here. And I'm really pleased you did come and talk with us this morning. And I thank you very much. I do. And I know your hands probably hurt, but I really wish you continued best. And let's just end this by saying, $50-$60 barrel crude is about where.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. If we could get $50 or $60 crude, I'd be happy camp.
Yeah.
No, I said back last summer, I said this is kind of unreal. Like they kept saying, telling me it was going to go on, but I couldn't see it really going on. It was too much, yeah. You know, really too much.
But if we get around, let's just say 60, producers like you will continue and...
Well, there's going to be producers here as long as there's Pennsylvania crude in the ground. And I don't foresee it running out. We've taken 150 years worth of it out of there now and we still have it, so... It's a little harder to get than a lot of crudes, other crudes, but as long as it's there, somebody's going to get it.
Right? 150 years from now.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Bill. Thank you very much.